What I Believe was the title of two separate essays by the philosopher Bertrand Russell and the novelist E.M. Forster in the early 20th century. These two humanist activists set out their approach to life, their fundamental worldview, in a way that was accessible to all. I'm Andrew Copson, Chief Exec of Humanists UK, and in this podcast, I'm talking to humanists today about what they believe, to understand more about the values, convictions, and opinions they live by.
Hello there. I'm Alice Roberts. I'm Vice President of Humanists UK, and you've found your way to this fantastic humanist podcast. So I'm thinking you might be interested in finding out a little bit more about Humanists UK, which is the national charity working on behalf of non-religious people to advance free thinking, to combat discrimination against non-religious people, and also promote generally a fairer, more tolerant society. If you'd like to support the podcast or find out more about the humanist approach to life and all the work of Humanists UK, please visit the website. It's easy to find if you just search for humanists.uk. If you like what you see there, please consider joining us as a member. I'll let you get back to the podcast.
Today I'm speaking with Adam Kay, award-winning writer, comedian and former doctor. His debut book, This Is Going to Hurt, was a literary sensation, a Sunday Times number one bestseller for over a year, translated into 37 languages and turned into a hit TV show for the BBC starring Ben Whishaw. He's also the author of another Sunday Times bestseller, Undoctored, the story of a medic who ran out of patients, and his latest children's book, Kay's Incredible Inventions, published just last week. He's also a patron of Humanists UK. Adam Kay, thank you for joining us on What I Believe.
Thank you for having me.
You've got many strings to your bow, of course, but one of the most well-known is that you're an ex-doctor. And so I thought we'd start there. When you were appearing at a Humanists UK event, I think last year or the year before, you spoke a lot about your experience in medicine and lots of other things too. But since this is a podcast about beliefs and values and your approach to life, there was one particular comment that I wanted to start with that you made there, which is that you said how supportive you were and how important were the values of the NHS. So let's start with telling me a little bit about that.
I mean, there's two ways of looking at what the values are of the NHS. One I agree with, one I don't. The version I agree with is why the NHS was set up in the first place, which is healthcare that's free at the point of service, based on your clinical need, never based on your bank balance or anything else. And that is the purest version of delivering healthcare that exists. There's no argument in my mind there's a better way of delivering healthcare than that. And ultimately, that's what that's what, for me, the NHS is, and everything that everyone who goes to work as a doctor, nurse, midwife, paramedic, physio, has in the background. And there's a more modern version of the values of the NHS, which is a constitution that the government put together, which listed various values, it's a bit like the sort of if you walk into a startup and it says what they're, what they strive for. It's things like we work together for patients. It's about respect and it's about dignity. It's about compassion. It's about everyone counts. It's about improving lives. And there's another one or two. And those are obviously all good things, but they're not specific to the NHS. And also, I don't believe that the NHS applies things like compassion, respect, and dignity to its own staff. Those are the official values of the NHS that you could probably look up on a website.
if you Googled values of NHS.
Values of NHS. Yeah, I think you'd get what the government's come up with. But for me, the values of the NHS are the ones that came 75 years ago, not 6 months ago.
Coming back to those original values, which of course came out of quite a long, you know, decades of thinking about, you know, what the purpose of healthcare was, what the rights of people were, and so on and so forth. What do you think? You know, why is that an important value to you? I mean, most societies around the world for most of the time haven't provided healthcare free to people for all sorts of reasons. What are the reasons why that is an important value? Free, at the point of need, you know, for everyone. What's the basis of that for you?
For me, it's the fact that we are all equal. It's what it comes down to. Everyone deserves the same, and the same should be good. And it feels so sort of, you know, treating everyone as your equal feels like such a good way to live your life. I've never known, obviously, old as I am, I'm not 75. I've never known anything other than the NHS growing up, and so it was my normal. But I have since encountered other healthcare systems, and they're very, very different. And I think that, you know, you don't know what you got till it's gone.
Right.
Joni Mitchell style. I've been a patient in America a couple of times. I'll tell you a story.
Go on.
We were in Miami. I think we'd been in America for work, and then we'd taken a bit of holiday afterwards. And it was the weird last day of the holiday, where you've already been booted out of your room and your flight is not for another 12 hours, and they say it's fine, you can use the pool or whatever. So we were using the pool and sat around this outdoor pool in Miami, and everything was good. And then I went to the loo and I sat down on the loo, and some sort of insect or something flew into my hair, and so I brushed it away with my hand, and then huge jets of blood started coming out of my hand.
Oh my God.
And I thought, this is, we don't say, oh my God, this is a humanist podcast.
No, I'm sorry. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
Oh my goodness. And so I knew that at that point, it probably wasn't an insect unless it had some sort of machete with it. And I looked around, what had happened is, as I sat back, there was a broken like picture frame behind me, and a sort of a triangle of glass had fallen into my hair. And then when I brushed it, I'd sliced into some kind of little arteriole. I remembered, I'd stopped being a doctor by this point, but I did know that was, you know, you had to stop the bleeding. Remember that bit. So I got loads of, and made up like a boxing glove of loo roll, and it was still like sort of spurting everywhere, and I was sort of going all over, and it was horrible. And I sort of eventually sort of stopped it, and I sort of stumbled back out of the loos and walked back around the pool to get to James, my husband, or my boyfriend, as he was at the time. Lots of people started screaming around the pool, which was fair enough. Although you'd think in the land of daily shootings, they'd be more accustomed to someone covered in blood wandering back to their sun lounger. Anyway, so I got back, and James was very insistent that we sort of seek a hospital-based remedy here. The duty manager of the hotel was even more keen that I was off the premises. So got to an emergency room, urgent care place, you know, round the corner. And, you know, I've been to a hospital reception lots of times as a punter. You know, you give your name, you say what the problem is, you sit on the chair, and it's America, so you hand over your credit card, and then you give your name and you say what the problem is. And right. So it was already a bit different. And then the care I got was excellent, but there were a couple of choices I had to make, which I'd never have to make if I was in an NHS hospital. The first was, they say, oh, so the wound is over a joint, and because it was glass, we would normally x-ray it just to check that there's no glass in the joint, which would make it a whole other palaver. And I knew that was right. I remembered that. And they said, but it will be an extra, whatever, $1,000 to do the x-ray. So I had to think, you know, and I'm someone with some medical knowledge. Do I need this? Do I want this? And then And I think I had the X-ray, and then afterwards it was like, and to close it, we've got a choice of, we can use glue or we can use stitches, and this one will give a better result, but it is $600 more expensive. Yeah. And I felt sorry for me, obviously, having to spend all this money, particularly as it turned out, I hadn't got any travel insurance. I thought I had travel insurance because I thought I had travel insurance my entire life because, I think my student bank account in 1998 that I opened said it had travel insurance. It had never occurred to me that might have expired at some point in the preceding decades. Anyway, so I felt sorry for me, but I also felt a bit sorry for the doctor who, when you go to medical school and, you know, you think about the difficult conversations you're going to have with people, I don't think that I'd be prepared to say to someone, you know, to bring into the finances of the operation into it.
Yeah. Would you like the best or the second best?
Yes. And this is, the feeling that you're upselling, like, I don't know, when you buy a sofa and they offer you Scotch Guard or whatever. I don't know. It felt icky. And I think, like, there was something in the news the other day about, you know, you should be charged X pounds if you don't turn up to your GP's appointment, or, you know, if you go to, I write about the NHS and every so often, and I know you should never look below the line, but then people do comment with, well, if you charge people £10 for turning up drunk at A&E, all of these ideas.
What do they betray? What is it you think that those ideas have behind them, which is wrong? Are you experienced in America or those ideas you're talking about now? What is it that makes you go, ugh, no?
It's unfair. It's a two-tier system, basically. And anytime there's a two-tier system, the people who have least get the worst. And all these people who write to the newspaper to say, oh, if you all you need to do is charge people a tenner for blah, blah, blah. A tenner for them is nothing. These people don't realise that for millions and millions of people in this country, a tenner isn't the difference between one Pret sandwich and another Pret sandwich. No. It's the difference between eating and heating. You know, it's so. And I fear that's the direction of travel we're on. And I think it's sad. And I think the NHS should never lose what it was set up for, which it already has lost a bit. I mean, I don't think there's such a thing as, basically, there's no such thing as NHS dentistry anymore. There's definitely practically no such thing as NHS IVF anymore, which I think is desperately sad.
Yeah, this idea of fundamental equality of people and treating them more fairly in a big system like that, is that something that in the background inspired you to go into medicine, or was it is it something that you've developed during your time in the NHS?
I mean, I'd love to say I went in with all the right reasons, but I defy any 16-year-old choosing their A-levels and deciding they want to go down the medicine. I mean, you know, for me, that's no more of an informed choice than, you know, drawing a picture age 5 saying you want to be an astronaut.
Yes.
I'd like to think that I was brought up with certain values, and, you know, treating people equally is fundamental to that. I think I saw a lot of inequality when I started working. I worked initially in a part of London, as with all parts of London, very, very cheek by jowl. And I met the richest people who I will probably ever meet. Probably the poorest people I will certainly meet in this country, on some really tough estates that are 400 yards away from massive stucco mansions. And you sort of, everyone exists in their own social circle normally. And you see, you know, you meet people one or two standard deviations away from you just by going out about your business. But for the first time in my, you know, in my early 20s, when I started working on the wards, that was the first time I'd sort of just seen what, you know, what the population of London actually was.
And that's a sort of social value in the NHS, isn't it? It's like everyone together. There aren't many places where you'd sit in the waiting room next to, you know, ... people who were so far outside of your social circle. So not just for doctors, but for patients, I think there's a sort of social
value. Yeah, I think it's amazing. And in the patients and also in the staff, in NHS is often described as a melting pot. The NHS is the single greatest advert for immigration. I mean, I've got skin in the game. I'm from immigrant stock, and I believe that immigration is, I have to think that immigration is amazing, because if this country wasn't so welcoming a couple of generations back, I wouldn't be here. And
no, me neither. No, exactly.
And so
lots of it.
Yeah. And I think the NHS is an amazing exponent of what happens when you open your arms and everyone works together.
Do you think that society values it enough? I mean, it is, you know, famously very much loved, and it appeared in the Olympic ceremony, and then there was a massive celebration in Westminster Abbey just last year, and then 5 years before that. So, you know, a lot of lip service is paid to it. But do you think that society values it as it should, or really understands it?
I think it values it. I think it probably doesn't understand it. So, and I think that's why I think there was quite a lot of interest in my first book, because I don't think there were that many books before it that sort of opened the bonnet in quite that way. I think people were interested. I think lots of people were surprised that, you know, a doctor moves hospital every 6 or 12 months and might have to move flat at the same time, or quite how bad the hours were, or quite what the money looks like when you divide, you know, your monthly salary by the huge number of hours you end up working. All this sort of thing, the way that staff are treated by their management as well as by the patient. But, you know, why should people know the ins and outs of an industry they don't work in? But I think it is very much loved. But I think the real question will come down to how much more money are we prepared to pay for it? And I think there is or should be a big reckoning coming, which is a grown-up conversation between us and the people we pay our taxes to, asking the question, do we want the NHS to continue the way that it was set up for, with those values that are 75 years old? And if the answer is yes, and I hope the answer is yes, then unfortunately it is going to be more expensive than it is at the moment, and we need to put our hands in our pockets. And that's when we find out how valued the NHS actually is, when it becomes, rather than a notional sense of value, when we actually have to do something about it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, you know, or we say, oh, I think I'm paying quite enough, and in that case we need a different system, a two-tier system, and, you know, I'll be all right. Lots of people listening to this will be all right, but so many people will not be all right. Just like we just said, the people who have the least suffer the most.
You've written about the need to support NHS staff more, and for the NHS as a system to value certain aspects of their staff experience more, particularly their mental well-being.
Yeah, I think it's no secret that there's currently a crisis in the retention of staff in the NHS. Last year, 10 doctors quit every single day. More doctors quit than retired. And that's just, you know, one single piece of the jigsaw. There's the thick end of 100,000 vacancies in the NHS. Mm-hmm. And it's getting worse. I mean, whatever a government might want to tell you, speak to someone who works there, they will say that more people are leaving than have ever left before. And, you know, we might be running the tap harder and trying to get more people in, but the plug's still out. And, you know, you need to put the plug back in before any other measures will work. And there are lots of reasons for this. I think pay is a very big one. And it's a different discussion, but I obviously stand with anyone who's striking to get fair pay in the NHS. But it's only part of it. That's part of looking after your staff. And And I think looking after staff's mental well-being, well-being full stop, is a huge thing. And I think it's something the NHS has historically done very badly.
Why is that, do you think, in an organisation that is about health, to put such a low value on its own people's health?
It's baffling. Only speaking for doctors, I think there's always been an approach that you're a bloody doctor and you bloody get on with it. And it's weakness to be sick. When I was, I worked in one job where if I was sick, I had to arrange my own sick cover.
Wow. That's a disincentive.
Yeah. So you text someone and they say, I'm really sorry, you couldn't cover me for labour ward tonight. They say, okay, fine. Can you do next Thursday for me? So you're not even getting sick leave. You're just sort of, it's just inconvenient. There was something going around on Twitter a week or so ago, where a trust had told their staff that if you take a day's sick leave, you're ineligible for doing any locum shifts for a month. So, I mean, and that's particularly disgusting within this sort of cost of living crisis to penalise. That isn't looking after your staff.
That's a very strange culture as well. I mean, that's an odd. Why is that, do you think? Because people don't. Doctors can't be sick. They're not allowed to be sick. People don't want to think of doctors as sick.
People don't want to think of doctors as sick is part of it, because people don't want to think of their doctors as humans, because humans make mistakes. So
right.
The person who's calculating the dose of your chemotherapy, the person who's making a millimeter accurate incision in some vital organ has to not be human. And you have to think of them as other. And that's why I think historically doctors have been put up on a very unhelpful pedestal. And some of them have started to believe that myth.
I've met them.
Yeah, we've all met them. And those are not good doctors, because it's a job about communication and it's a job about rapport. And you can be the most fantastic brain in the world and tell the patient exactly what the drug is that you think they must be taking. And you may well be right. But if you don't have any rapport with your patient, they're just not going to listen to you. They're not going to take the drug, and you might as well not have been there in the first place. So, and which is an argument, which is another big topic, that we're recruiting the wrong people, and we need to recruit broader across society, and we need to, drop the insistence on all these A's at A level and make it all about, you know, communication and being honest about the problems with the job, and you know, how you're going to cope with the bad days. So, and coming back to your point, during all of my years at medical school, including various communication skills, you know, lectures and modules or whatever, no one once said, oh, by the way, you are going to have some bad days and this is how you deal with them. And that there are answers for how you deal with this stuff. It's a job that generally deals in evidence, you know, and which is, I imagine, something that marries well with a humanist belief. You sort of, it's about evidence, not about whim or sort of vague belief or hope. It's or faith. It's about evidence. And when you go to see your GP and they say, I think you've got asthma, and we're gonna start you on this inhaler, they're choosing the drug based on evidence. They're not saying, oh, I don't know, well, it's a full moon, so maybe we'll just start you on Monte Lucast rather than salbutamol or whatever. So that's all about evidence. There's evidence for how, if you've had a very bad day at work, you know, what to do in terms of, there's evidence for taking time out. There's obviously evidence for speaking to people. There's evidence for all sorts of things. But for whatever reason, it's just been ignored. And the idea is that you can just put it away. You can bottle it up. And bottling things up works. It works. And you can always do it. But it only works short term. You can bottle something up. You can put it away in the box. And it'll stay there for a bit. And you can go back to work the next day. And you can force yourself to smile. And, you know, and that the box will explode open at some point. And you have no idea when that's going to happen. And that's why it's always a bad idea to put it in the box, even though it feels like at the time it worked and you got away with it. So it's a cultural thing. Medicine is probably a couple of decades behind society in terms of stigma, shame, taboo relating to mental health. There was a there was something on Twitter a couple of years ago, which I thought was amazing. And it was doctors taking photos of their antidepressants and their lithium and their antipsychotics and talking openly, saying, I am a doctor and I take these drugs. I have mental health diagnosis, and I'm a doctor, and all is good. And I was shocked to see that, because that is such a step forward. There was so much shame when I worked that I don't think people would say that they were having counselling.
Really?
It was...
It sounds like a sort of quite like, almost like a old-fashioned Alpha City type environment.
I'd agree. And I get invited these days to talk to various, organisations. I'll be invited by lawyers or bankers or whoever's. And even the army. And I think all these sort of various old-fashioned institutions are now starting to get it right. And, they've got I'll be invited to speak by their global head of well-being. They do have a global head of well-being, which means that someone is thinking about it. And in the NHS, we've got all these czars. I was talking to, I don't know if you, Claire Gerada, who
she's one of our
members. One of your members. Excellent. And yeah. I've known Claire since I was three, because she used to work around the corner from my dad. They were both GPs. And what she's done for the mental well-being of NHS staff is absolutely unmatched and unparalleled. And she's talked in the past about having a czar for the well-being of NHS staff, having someone just take responsibility for that. And I think that's what it needs, because every hospital say, no, we're doing loads. We've got Zumba classes now, but the Zumba is fine, great, but that should be the icing on the cake. You need to get the basics right. You need to, anytime someone is a second victim, which is a slightly weird term for when you as a healthcare professional are involved in something that doesn't go well, right. You're described as a second victim, which is ultimately why I left the profession after my own bad day at work. But every time that happens, someone should be routinely offered X amount of counselling, and should be routinely offered time off work if they wanted.
There should be a standard.
That should be a standard. And some hospitals, some places are absolutely great, and but some hospitals just don't. And I think that is something. Some targets are good, some targets are bad. And there, I've seen some of each. But I think you can force or encourage a hospital to meet certain criteria. And I think that insisting that there is a bare minimum duty of care to staff is so important. And also will save the NHS so much money.
Exactly. All these things always, any staff well-being measures, like any staff health measures, save money in the end. They're effective and efficient. Exactly. You mentioned a moment ago the importance with medical practitioners of all sorts, I guess, of communication. Almost you went so far as to imply that the technical skills could be easily taught if we were recruiting good communicators into those professions. I don't want to dwell more on that, but for yourself, was that an important part of the work for you, the connection and the communication and the relationships with patients and their families and friends?
Yeah, that's the thing I miss most.
Right.
There's the thing, the global concept of helping people. I miss being a useful member of society, which I think is important. And I'd like to think that, I do believe very strongly about the importance of the arts, and hopefully some of the stuff I do help people in some way. But I'd have to have quite the ego
as an author. You're still useful.
However, you'd have to have an amazing ego to think that compares useful wise to saving lives on labour. But digging down into what it is I actually miss day to day, I miss colleagues, and more than colleagues, I miss I miss patients and I miss speaking to people. And it's medicine made me a much, much better communicator. I am an essentially introverted person, and I went to medical school sort of much deeper into my shell than I am now. I find it awkward speaking to new people, and medicine forced me to speak to new people because that's what the job is. Yeah. And it taught me that I like meeting new people. And I do miss that. Now I do a job where, you know, I'm sat on a laptop typing a book, and sometimes I get half an hour to speak to someone over a Zoom like this.
Your next book is another book for children, an excellent book for children, about inventions. Inventions that have changed the world and inventions that haven't. And, you know, as you're reading through the book, which I had the pleasure of doing, both of those types of invention are equally interesting, actually, and equally funny in the book. Why do you think it's... why did you want to write a book like that? I mean, there's a competition, I think, being launched at the same time as it as well, to get children interested in inventing. And this is an interesting concept to do a book about, because it's something specific, isn't it? It's not just, you know, science. It's not just curiosity. It's specifically inventing
things. It is. But it's a confidence trick, because ultimately it is a science textbook.
Right.
And a bit of a history textbook. And... I've written a couple of children's books before, which are also confidence tricks. Hopefully no children will hear this and find this out. So my first one was called Kay's Anatomy, which took the human for 8 to 12 year olds. And it was sort of sold as a disgusting guide to the human body. And it was. I mean, there are more bodily fluids mentioned on every page than possibly any book in humanity. And it was written in a funny, silly way. But at the same time, it didn't just cover all of the science they need to, you know, human biology they need for, you know, GCSE and beyond, in fact. But it also meant that I could talk about smoking, and I could talk about alcohol and body image, and I can talk about neurodiversity and all sorts of these important things. And hopefully, because I've made them giggle and I've talked about poo, then they trust me
a lot.
They'll trust me when I talk about the other more serious stuff. And I've had loads of messages from parents saying it's been really helpful, you know, seeing, you know, their, you know, whatever medical condition, their diabetes, you know, discussed, and then they can show it to their friends, and their friends can understand. I thought, oh, great. Mm-hmm. But I've tricked all these people into that. And I've written a couple of children's books since. This is my latest one. And I think science is amazing and brilliant and you know, and wonderful, and everyone should be as interested in it as I am. But for whatever reason, lots of science doesn't get the same billing as, you know, dinosaurs and, you know.
Right.
And so you need a way in, I think, and hopefully learning about, you know, the sort of the disastrous story that, you know, the stories that led to, you know, electricity or something, you know, they'll hear about all the electrocutions and the failed flights and the early toilets and what happened before loo roll.
Yeah.
But through all that, they will learn some basic science and learn some stuff. And the dream is that then inspires them to read another book about whichever corner of science or technology that they're interested in.
I was hoping that you might say something about how, you know, inventiveness was a particular concept for you, and you love invention and dynamism, and, you know, but it's more science generally, is it? And the joy of finding things out and stimulating curiosity.
It's that. It's also reading for pleasure is so important. Reading for pleasure is an extraordinary statistic. Sounds like it's totally wrong. It can't be right, but look it up. I think the National Literacy Trust did the research on this. Reading for pleasure is the single biggest determinant of a child's success in later life, more than their, you know, anything else about their upbringing, their background, their parents, their anything. So, and fewer kids have books in their lives. And which is sad. And in fact, World yes. Book Day, who give away these free, you know, you get your £1 voucher and you swap that. I was involved with that last year, and there was a statistic that, you know, because they said, yeah, we'd love to have you involved, and they just sent us sort of a page of sort of facts about kids and reading. And the one, you know, I was obviously always going to say yes, but the fact that made it sort of undeniable was, I think it's a fifth of kids, the only book that the books that they own themselves are these free World Book Day books. So yes. I realize how privileged I was growing up for all sorts of reasons, but not least because I went to a school full of books, and I grew up in a home full of books. And and I've had lots of messages about my nonfiction books for kids saying that the kids who haven't been readers really got into it. And in fact, perhaps I think a disproportionate number from parents of neurodiverse kids saying right. that for whatever reason, this was the first book that they read start to finish. Now they've read it five times and they can't wait for your next book. And so I love the idea that this is getting some kids into reading books, because all books are different, aren't they? You know, we're lucky as adults. We've got, you know, a huge choice of if we like to read science fiction, fantasy, if we like a memoir, if we like a crime book, if we like a literary fiction, whatever it is, there's something for it. But I think the nonfiction space for kids has historically been quite small. And I think particularly the funny nonfiction.
Yeah, so encyclopedic where it exists. Yeah. It's sort of like fact books or whatever. It's not much fun. Yeah.
So you'd love the answer to be that I'm an inventive person and come and look at my Heath Robinson stuff in the spare room. But I really enjoy writing, and I love that it's getting some kids interested in reading.
That's a very revealing answer too, so that's fine. Fundamental Human Equality, The Melting Pot of the NHS, Thinking of Doctors as Human, The Inspiration of Science and Reading for Pleasure. Thank you, Adam, for telling us what you believe.
Thank you.
What I Believe is a weekly podcast from Humanist UK. If you'd like to support the podcast, find out more about humanism, Humanist UK and the work that we do, you can find out more on the Humanist UK website, humanists.uk. And if you like what you see, please consider signing up as a member or a supporter. You can also find out more about humanism by purchasing the Sunday Times bestseller, The Little Book of Humanism, available at all good bookshops.